due to some traffic situations. Our first, Mr.
Link.
You were here on Bigsby?
On Mr. Schley's case.
You were here on Schley, yes. Okay. The first matter then is Inri Matthew Schley.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gregory Link. I represent Mr. Schley and his personal restraint petition here this morning. The department's revocation of Mr. Schley's DOSA sentence deprived him of due process on a number of bases. First, the court could I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? Thank you. The department used the incorrect standard of proof. It failed to engage in the case-by-case analysis this court directed it do so in Grisby. And it violated its own regulations regarding the limitations on the sanctions that could be imposed. Addressing first the standard of proof the department used here, this court in McKay made clear that due process requires that the facts underlying a DOSA revocation, whether it's in custody DOSA or whether it's an out-of-custody DOSA, that the facts underlying that revocation must be established by the department by a preponderance of the evidence. And what it requires is something more than what the department believes. The department here believes that as long as some intermediary using a lower standard of proof makes a finding of the relevant facts, that a subsequent hearing examiner can simply find by preponderance that that intermediary actually made that finding without reexamining whether the facts actually establish the allegations by a preponderance. And that reduces due process to a shell.
Gronquist isn't it inconsistent with your argument?
It's not in any way, because in Gronquist, the various hearings all involved the same standard of proof. There wasn't this question of elevating a some evidence standard of proof into a preponderance of the evidence standard of proof.
That's not exactly correct, is it? I mean, there's infractions, there's really no due process attaches to that, as opposed to the serious infractions. There is a minimal due process attaches to that.
In Gronquist, however, the department used the exact same standard of proof for the infractions as well as the subsequent.
You're
finding.
Saying some evidence standard was used for every process.
No, in fact, they used a higher standard, I believe. Oh, excuse me, you're right. They used the some evidence standard across the board,
right.
And that was fine. Here we're going from some evidence to preponderance of the evidence, and no one has ever found the underlying allegations occurred by preponderance of the evidence. Let's be clear. What the department has done is it has vested its DOSA treatment providers with the authority to revoke a DOSA sentence based solely on some evidence.
Does the record tell us when the department started bifurcating this process instead of having the underlying infraction and the DOSA revocation as one hearing, as happened in McKay, and doing the two separate hearing processes? Is this a response to McKay?
I looked briefly. I couldn't answer that question because I had the same question. Was this a response to McKay? Because it certainly is a neat workaround, McKay. It really requires the department do nothing. Now, in McKay, they had held a joint hearing, and that's somewhat different from what we have here. They used a joint hearing where she was found guilty of the infraction and revoked at the same hearing based on the same standard of evidence. And the department didn't do that here. But what they're doing is not in any way fundamentally different, because, again, the DOSA provider terminates him from treatment based solely on the sum evidence standard. And based on that termination alone, his DOSA sentence is revoked. That's the fundamental. The underlying facts are not the fact of termination. It is the fact that he fought. And we know that to be true because if we look at DOC's own disposition report, on the DOSA revocation, they say that. The hearing officer says the most significant witness testimony was the physical violence Mr. Schley was found guilty of. This action is what put him in direct violation of the program's rule. They go on to say Mr. Schley placed his DOSA sentence in jeopardy by his behaviors. Again, the hearing examiner themselves doesn't quite get what the department wants them to do because they're plainly relying on the allegations of fighting. They're not limiting themselves to the fact of termination. They're relying on the all the while they're doing that, telling Mr. Schley, you can't litigate that question. And we go beyond that. In Grisby, this court said you have to have a case-by-case determination of whether an attorney should be appointed. The department's still not doing that either. And if we look at the advisement they provided Mr. Schley, and I suggest that's the same advisement they're providing to every other inmate, they expressly tell them, you cannot have anyone else represent you. That is not what
you,
this
you
court...
Think, is there a distinction between an out-of-custody revocation that was discussed in Grisby and an in-custody revocation like we have here?
I don't know that there is because, as the court said in McKay, it was applying the same level of due process regardless of whether it was in custody or out of custody, not because of the location of the hearing.
But McKay was only discussing, they didn't discuss the attorney issue in McKay, did they?
No, but they talked about the due process ramifications of the DOSA revocation, and they said there's no distinction.
For the elevated standard of proof as opposed to advising right to counsel?
I think the same is true, because when you elevate the standard of proof, you elevate the complexities of the hearing, and I think that has to factor into the question.
Is there a case that says that?
There's not a case that directly says you have to have an attorney.
Links the two. That links the standard of proof and the right to counsel.
Well, Grisby itself does, because it talks about the complexities of the case. And I think it stands to reason that as you raise the standard of proof, you raise the legal complexities of the case. I don't think that's a controversial point. In direct answer to your question, no, I can't point to a specific case that says that. But the due process analysis is a balancing of the various rights, liberties, and the state's interests. But again, if we look at McKay, and there's no difference in terms of the liberty interest at stake in a DOSA revocation, whether it occurs in custody or out of custody. I think the same holds true with respect to the right to counsel question under Grisby. The court should recognize that when you revoke someone's sentence and you double the term of incarceration, whether you do that out of custody or whether you do that in custody, you're still adding 30 months to your sentence. You're still significantly limiting a person's liberty interest. And you're significantly frustrating, as this court in McKay said, the public's interest in seeing that this person get the treatment they need.
Do you think that there was something particularly complex about this case that would have required the appointment of counsel?
I think the fact illustrated by the department that it doesn't understand the proper standard of proof is a complexity that an attorney could have helped disabuse them of.
Do you think an attorney could have persuaded the hearing examiner to?
Well, I'm not sure anyone can persuade DOC necessarily, but someone could have certainly said, look, you're using the wrong standard of proof, and let's be. And I think the appellate process would have been would have functioned quicker. I think perhaps as it moved up the chain in DOC's own appellate process, the examiners would have said, yeah, you know what, they're right, and we could have put this to bed. I think there's a valuable role to the right to counsel, and I've asked the court to reaffirm that role. Thank you.
May it please the court, Alex Costin for Washington Department of Corrections. This court should hold that the department complied with Washington law when it applied properly the preponderance of evidence standard at Mr. Schley's DOSA revocation hearing. Per In re Gronquist, Mr. Schley's fighting infraction that was final before the revocation hearing could not be litigated because the revocation hearing dealt solely with his termination from treatment.
Did any fact finder ever find by a preponderance of the evidence that the fight occurred?
No, Your Honor, but...
In Gronquist, was the same standard of proof applied in each proceeding?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor, but I think...
Do you know a single case where a finding based on a lower standard was given preclusive effect in a subsequent hearing with a higher standard of proof?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. But in the Gronquist was not about the standard of proof, however. In the Gronquist was about the finality. And what Gronquist said, as long as your infraction is final, that's all that matters at the subsequent hearing.
Well, isn't that giving it preclusive effect because it's final?
Once the infraction is final, Your Honor, this is it. That's what the hearing officer told Mr. Gronquist. That's what the hearing officer told Mr. Schley. But even if we apply preponderance of evidence standard, Mr. Schley's infraction would still be upheld. The hearing officer relied not only on confidential informant statement, as Mr. Schley appears to suggest. He was relying on the nature and number of injuries Mr.
So are you asking us to the hearing officer only made the finding based on some evidence. That's undisputed. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. But what
so are you asking us to weigh the evidence again and apply it to apply a higher standard and reach a conclusion on that?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that under either standard, that original infraction would still stand. But what is at stake here is that I think Mr. Schley's has a fundamental misunderstanding of what happened in McKay and what happened in this case. In McKay,
can you answer the question about what when the department began to bifurcate these hearings? Was that a response to McKay?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I was looking at the department's policy that dealt with the failure to complete or termination from treatment, and that dates all the way to 2000. That was way beyond before the McKay. So I disagree with my opponent that the department was somehow amending its standard to kind of avoid preponderance of evidence standard. It's just not true.
So how did it happen in McKay that the two matters were tried together?
That was just a mistake that the department made. And what is important in McKay, and I think that's what Mr. Schley fails to understand, is that Ms. McKay was charged with failure to complete treatment. That was the issue before the hearing officer in McKay. Mr. Schley, on the other hand, was charged with having been terminated from treatment. That's two different things, because infraction 762 says you're accused of failing to complete or having been terminated from treatment. The only issue in front of the hearing officer in Schley was the fact of Mr. Schley's termination from treatment, and that's what she was required to find by preponderance of evidence if he was terminated from treatment. There was more than sufficient evidence for the hearing officer to find that he was terminated from treatment.
Isn't that kind of artificial when the reason for termination is the fighting? I mean, you've got foundational facts lead to an ultimate fact. Shouldn't all of the facts be found by the same standard?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. His infraction, his fighting infraction, was final. He had a chance to appeal it. He appealed it. He lost. On the basis of his...
Let's back up. Let's assume due process says that you're entitled to have the facts that support the decision determined by preponderance of the evidence. Why is it only some of the facts and not all of the facts?
Well, Your Honor, here, Mr. Schley, the reason he was terminated from treatment was not fighting. The reason he was terminated from treatment was because he violated a cardinal rule of zero tolerance to violence in the treatment community.
And how did he do that?
He was found guilty of fighting.
Exactly. And that was not established by a preponderance.
It was not established by the preponderance, but as I was saying earlier, Your Honor, even if this court was to apply preponderance of evidence standard, Mr. Schley fighting infraction would still stand. In addition to the evidence that I was mentioning earlier, nature and number of injuries, confidential informant statements, in preparation for this argument, the department found statements by the defender Mr. Schley fought with that fully supported the confidential informant statements that
in preparation for this argument as opposed to in preparation for the hearing to establish whether he had been fighting?
Well, there was no attorney at the...
I mean, why would you be looking at what the evidence is now instead of what the evidence is at the time the fact finder is going to decide what happened?
Well, we would be looking for that because what we're saying is that under either standard, his original fraction would stand. And so if the court wishes the department to produce this statement from the other offender, the department is certainly willing to do that. Going to the argument that Mr. Schley was that Grisby required provision of counsel. Well, apart from the fact that Grisby was decided 7 months after Mr. Schley's infraction. And at that time, the department properly relied on McNeil that said that Mr. Schley was not entitled to counsel.
Well, let's say we sent this back for another hearing using the preponderance of evidence standard. If that happened, would the department feel like it was be required to give Mr. Schley notice of a right to counsel on a case-by-case basis?
Yes. But apart from the fact that Grisby was decided 7 months after the fact, let's just concentrate on what Grisby actually said. Mr. Schley appears to suggest that the department was obligated to provide counsel to him, but that's not the case. As Grisby reiterated, Gagnon versus Scarpelli provision, that it's left to the sound discretion of the department to appoint counsel for Mr. Schley. So Mr. Schley never requested counsel at any hearing. He never raised this issue in his appeal with the DOC or with the or in his personal restraint petition. In fact, this is just...
Normally, before somebody waives a right, they have to know about it. Is there anything in the record that shows that Mr. Schley had any information to tell him that he could ask for an attorney?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the notification that the department provided was correct. It said you have no...
You're not answering my question. Your notice says he's not entitled to bring a hired attorney to the hearing. He has no statutory right to an attorney. My question is there anything in the record that shows that anybody told Mr. Schley that he could ask for a lawyer?
Well, the notice said that you will not be appointed an attorney unless the hearing administrator...
Notice, since you and I aren't going to get to harmony on what that notice means, other than that notice, is there anything to show that Mr. Schley was told he had the right to ask for a lawyer?
Not at the time. No, he could. He could not be, because at the time McNeil was.
So the answer is no, there's nothing besides the notice to show that Mr. Schley was aware that he could ask for an attorney.
Yes, Your Honor, and the notice was adequate. Does the court have any questions of me?
No.
In conclusion, the department respectfully asks this court to hold that under McKay, department properly applied preponderance of evidence standard at Schley's revocation hearing. Under Indrik Gronquist, Schley could not relitigate the finding infraction that was final before his DOS revocation hearing. Under Grisby and Gagnon versus Scarpelli, Mr. Schley did not have a statutory right to appointment of counsel. That was left to the sound discretion of the department, and based on the facts of Mr. Schley's case, even if he requested counsel, he would not be entitled to one because the facts were simple. Mr. Schley was more than able to adequately represent himself, and therefore he would not be appointed counsel even if he requested one. Thank you.
I think it's clear that the department wants to give preclusive effect to a finding made out on lower standard, and I due process just doesn't tolerate that. There's nowhere in law where we take findings based on a lower standard of proof and then simply elevate them the chain and say, and that meets the standard of a higher proof. There's nowhere. The state can't cite any place. We don't do that with collateral estoppel. We don't do it in criminal law, civil law, and due process won't tolerate it here either. Mr. Schley is entitled to have someone find, by a preponderance of the evidence, the facts that underlie his revocation. And as the department has made clear, the facts that underlie his revocation are the allegations of fighting. That's why they revoked him from his DOSA. That's what he's entitled to have the department prove by a preponderance. I'd ask the court to remand it back for a hearing that complies with McKay. And I'd ask the court to direct the department that they cannot comply with Grisby by telling people you can't have someone represent you. That's not what Grisby said. What Grisby said is you might be able to have someone represent you. That notice that they provided Mr. Schley will never comply with Grisby. And as long as they're providing that notice to other inmates, they will never meet the obligations of due process. So I'd ask the court to do those two things. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.